You are listening to the podcast of the Matyas Corvinus Collegium, the largest talent management institute in Hungary. If you want to know more about our mission, please look up our English website at mcc.hu/en or check out our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter channels for interesting articles and analysis of our professors, external contributors, and students. Look up our knowledge base at corvinak.hu/en.
Okay, so this is the third part of our podcast with Callum Nicholson, and I should start with stating that the keystone of your book is the critical approach, as you mentioned, to the paradigms that shape our views on these topics. And one of the most significant ones is that we think of a causal link between climate change and migration. And you pointed out that you think that there isn't a causal link between them. Can you tell us why this approach can be misleading? I mean, if we think that there is a causal link, why can it be misleading?
Well, it's not that I'm saying there isn't a causal link. My point's more about I'm not sure how we would define one. The thing is, with this topic, it's very easy to say that there is a causal link. But the thing is, if that can then mean anything, in my view, it's closer to meaning nothing than it is to meaning something. So if something can be, if you say, I mean, often if you see definitions of climate migration, they fall into one of two problems. Either they are so specific in their causality that it's not a very generalizable concept, so it has no utility. So you say, here's a sinking island, a very, very small island with a few hundred people on it, and these people are climate migrants. And you think, okay, fine. But if it's such a small number of people being affected, why do we need a big regime internationally about climate migration? It'd be very easily absorbed. So in a sense, if it's so specific, why are we talking about it in such general abstract terms about climate migration as opposed to just Tuvalu or Kiribati having problems? But then there's the opposite approach people have where they define it as so general that it can include everything. So for instance, I mentioned this Nature Climate Change paper. When they said we can't talk about climate migration, they went on to say we should instead talk about climate mobility. But I read their paper very carefully, and the way they've defined mobility is it includes not just migration, but immobility, people who do not migrate. So really everyone, in which case, because you must be either mobile or immobile, yes, by definition. There's no one who won't fit into that. And then in terms of climate, they define climate as not just climate, but also political economy, by which point they're really talking about everything. So really what they were recommending is that we should shift from a specific idea that there is climate and there is migration and a causal link, because they say we can't identify the causal link. And then they're shifting to saying, well, we should call it climate mobility, which is really to say everything affects everything. At which point you say, well, what's the added value of that argument? And so and this is a problem that runs through social sciences, of the problem of saying something so particular that you cannot generalize from it. And the opposite problem is saying something so general, then you can't derive any specific implication from it. And social science is always stuck between these two things. It's the old structure agency problem. Is society run by structural factors, or is it free will and agency of the individual? There's never been a resolution to this sort of problem, because in a sense, it's a distinction in language. Because we all know the real world is never this simple either direction. But our language tempts us and bewitches us into thinking that we can eventually, with enough careful thought, arrive at an answer. I don't know about you, but I don't really, nothing in my life's ever told me that's true. None of the more fundamental questions have I ever found an answer to on any topic, personal or professional in that sense. But what you do gain over the years is a bit more humility in the face of the questions. And I think what we're facing across these sorts of topics is actually an epidemic of hubris, where people think that answers exist, that we can find them, and once found, we can act upon them. But I'm not sure either of those three assumptions can be sustained once you actually encounter reality. So if you look at the climate migration topic, I'm not strictly saying we cannot identify causality. My point is more to say, I don't even know what people are talking about when they talk about causality. Uh-huh. And the onus is on them to identify that, to ascertain what would be a threshold for a valid causal claim. So in a sense, the problem is less to do with the climate or even migration. It's more to do, again, with ourselves. It's the frame of reference we bring to the questions. That's where the failure is. And I think the danger, I think you said the danger of people presuming there is a causal claim and there is none. Well, the danger, I think, is a very obvious one, that when ideas are propagated by academics and then are let loose in the culture like a virus, yes, they go viral across the culture, and they take on a life of their own, and they can be used and abused with expediency by a whole range of actors with their own agendas. And so, for instance, one thing we've seen is, you know, if you have legitimate political refugees leaving a country, if they arrive and people say, well, actually, they were driven by a drought in that country, then they're climate migrants. And then what happens then is people can say, well, they're not real refugees. They don't fit under the Refugee Convention. And so actually, people who are trying to help the climate migrants are actually not helping political refugees. And also, if you look at, say, Syria and the war in Syria a few years ago, and you look at, if you say, well, this is all a climatic problem because of drought, right? What you do is absolve people like Assad of any responsibility for the problem. So the effect of the climate migration discourse is, I believe, often to depoliticize political issues, which I think does a certain violence to everything. And this is kind of to come back to the Jonathan Sumption point, is that there is a danger in society of science not just being a light that shows us the world, but increasingly it's a sort of overexposing light that's blinding us to the world. It's a flat light where if we interpret everything, if politicians can always say we were just following the science, then we dissolve the sense of the political and we dissolve the sense of responsibility. And so in this sense, science can be a tool, but it can be a tool for use, and it can also be a tool for absolving oneself of any responsibility. And this is one of the dangers we face now, that I feel a lot of the discussion around these issues is being used. People used to say knowledge is power, right?
Yeah.
I believe that also we can say that obfuscation is power. That's obfuscation, meaning the making things ambiguous and unclear, that's power. Because if you are speaking in language that no one can say what you mean...
Raising critical questions.
Well, this is it. Because if your language can mean anything, it also, and therefore closer to nothing, one of the advantages of it meaning anything is that I can't tell you were wrong. I can't tell you were false in what you said. Because I can't even work out how to begin to assess that.
And where to start and where to finish.
Yeah, and so this is bad for society. Because, you know, if in democracy it's about holding power accountable, how do you hold power accountable when the language is so vague? And I feel that what's happening in these sort of technocratic areas through these big institutions like the UN and so on is the language is increasingly so vague, but at the same time so laden with sentiment that it becomes hard to actually challenge it on two fronts. One is that if you disagree or you challenge it, you sound like you're, you know, a climate denier or something and not a good person. But also it's very hard to do anyway to challenge because it's unclear what precisely you're challenging because the words could mean anything and nothing. And this is the big problem we're facing. And the problem is not science. The problem is scientism. The problem is the use and abuse of the idea of science by society,
yes,
and by political actors. And I think the climate migration, indeed climate debate, is just one example of this.
I don't want to spoil the content and the conclusions of this book, but while I was reading it, I felt like this is a huge contribution into the academic world and the academic debate especially. And do you think that the aim of this book, namely to clarify and the term and potentially most misconceived ideas, was successfully achieved?
Well, first of all, thank you for your very generous comments. I mean, I'm not sure if it'll, I'm not sure what the reaction will be. I mean, typically, I mean, I think a book raising critical perspectives like this may simply be ignored, actually. So there's always that danger. Well, I mean, I'm happy with the book. I wasn't sure how it would go. It's an edited collection because, of course, you have contributors coming in. I was very fortunate because I had a wish list, like a dream list of contributors, and virtually all the people I wanted in it agreed to do it. And they wrote excellent pieces. I'm very proud of it. I'm proud of their pieces. I like my piece. I think Benoit's piece, we top and tail it. I do an opening one, and yeah, he does a closing one, and there's a symmetry to the whole thing. One thing we really tried to do with this book was to make sure it progressed an argument. One of the problems with a lot of edited collections is they are structured like this. They go this and this and this and this in terms of the contributions. But we want to do this, therefore this, therefore this, therefore this. So we divided the book into three sections that we think have a logical order.
So there is a causality between
Well, because what we do in the book is in part one, we have a few chapters by different authors talking about the question of what is climate migration? That is, what are the problems with it? What do people think it is and what is the problems causally? Part two is saying not what is it, but what does the concept do in society, not just despite, but maybe because of the causal problems in part one. And in part three, we're saying what can we do instead to avoid the use and abuse outlined in part two and given the problems outlined in part one. And so we've tried to concatenate an argument throughout doing this in the structure. And overall, I think it was successful. I mean, things can always be improved, but I thought it was, you know, I'm happy with it. So I think we achieved what we wanted to do, but whether that has any impact whatsoever is who knows. But what helps, obviously, is talking about it on things like this.
And hopefully our listeners will read it in the future.
Hope so.
And last but not least, I'm very curious about your opinion about climate migration.
Yeah.
Is it a threat from a Western standpoint? Is it a threat or is it an opportunity?
Migration or climate migration?
Well, let's just focus on migration firstly.
Migration, yeah. Because, yes. I mean, my point with climate migration is I'm not sure who it refers to precisely. In terms of migration, I think the thing is with migration, it's obviously a very hot political issue. And at the end of the day, by analogy, when you are sick, you know you're sick, right? But you need to go to a doctor to get diagnosed in order to treat the illness. Now, often we know when it comes to physical illness, we know there's a difference between symptoms and pathology. So take the Black Death. There were the pustules people had on their bodies. But that wasn't the disease, that was the symptom. The disease was something else they didn't quite understand. And until they worked out what the disease was, they weren't doing a good job tackling it, right? And I think that when we think of social problems, we have the same problem, that often we look at symptoms and we think we don't like the symptom and we think the symptom is the problem. And then we get into political debates as to whether it's a symptom or a cure. So if you look at the political right, they look at migration as a disease in need of a cure. If you look at the political left, they tend to see migration as a cure to a disease, right? Mm-hmm. Because the right tend to focus on migration as a disease for national identities, and the left seem to see migration as a cure for economic, you know, labor markets and things like this.
Especially in the European Union.
Yeah, and I think both sides have a blind spot because I don't think the left take enough consideration of identity issues and how important they are, how not everything that's meaningful can be put in a spreadsheet. And the left sometimes ignore this. The right are sometimes naive. They don't recognize that you still need to pay attention to the spreadsheet. You still need to have a growing economy in this culture. But this gets at, I think, the real problem is that as long as we have a central political imperative of economic growth, which is quite a new phenomenon, by the way. It's only the last 150 years it's been one. If you look at Europe, Europe grew 82% by best estimates between the year 1000 and 1500. That's how much China grew between 2002 and 2008. Basically, my point is economic growth is quite a new phenomenon. It's a historical exception, not the rule. If you look at economic growth rates, they went with birth rates because the more mouths there were to feed, the more jobs there were and so on, right? So there was a vicious or virtuous cycle, or whatever you want to phrase it. But obviously what's happened is as societies develop, what we've discovered is birth rates drop off. So increasingly the imperative of economic growth remains on a steady incline. Every year, politicians need to oversee economies that grow. The one guaranteed way to lose for a government to fall is after 4 years to have overseen even just a flat economy, let alone a declining economy. But if you're growing, you're probably going to be fine. But what's happening is economies are growing while the populations are declining. So how do you fill that gap? How do you maintain the growth? Well, if birth rates aren't serving it, then maybe you turn to immigration. And this is what Meloni in Italy has discovered.
As far as I'm concerned, there are two main approaches to this. When you mentioned that, okay, we should use migration as an asset.
Yeah.
To replace the workforce, and that's what the political left says.
Yeah.
The second one is to raise the fertility rate.
Well, this is it. And I have to say that governments have often tried to impact demographics, and typically government efforts are like, it's like having a hose pipe trying to push back the ocean. I mean, it doesn't matter whether governments are trying to grow the economy, grow the population, or indeed killing the population. It very rarely has impact on demographic trends. If you ever want to see an interesting range of stats, go look at the population of the Soviet Union before, during, and after World War II. 30 million Soviets died in that during that war, but every year the population was going up because it's because the demographic power is so strong. And I'm not a specialist on demography and these sorts of things, but I do think that I'm not sure government really has the scope and the power to incentivize shifts in demography. It's not that I disagree with it politically. I'm just not sure how effective it can be. But my point here is not about my point I'm trying to make here with growth is to say that when people look at migration, whether they praise or condemn migration, at an analytical level, I think we got to see it as a symptom. Whether you like migration or not, it's neither a cure nor a disease. I think it's a symptom of a deeper problem, which is to do with the status of economic growth in our political life cycle. Now, I'm not a degrowther either. I don't have a political view on that issue. But I do think analytically, it seems kind of obvious to me that when we discuss migration, is it a threat or not? If you don't think it is, then you don't think it is. But if you think it is, well, you've got to diagnose what's it a symptom of? How do we solve that problem? There's a lot of difficulties analytically around migration. But I do think it's true that something I do agree with increasingly is the idea that the more accelerated diversification there is, it does raise problems. I've just come back from Sweden, and I was in Uppsala.
Yes.
And they have increasing, really difficult problems there with gang crime and so on, which I believe, and I'm not an expert on this issue, I believe it's mostly in the last 5 or 6 years since they took in a lot of asylum seekers, and they could be Kurds and they could be Syrians and so on. And they've had a whole range of violent gang issues and bombings of like honor killings of each other's families and things. And to some extent, these situations are happening within these minority communities, these immigrant communities. But increasingly, they are affecting the rest of society. So, you know, yes, bombing the wrong house or something, and it's changing the politics. So, so it's self-evident, I think, that there are issues around this. So is migration a problem? Yeah, I think there are challenges that are coming from it. But I think ultimately we need to understand that migration goes up and down with the business cycle. That, you know, the international migration has always stayed at around 3% of the population for the last 150 years, with one exception, which was 1991. And that wasn't because there was more migration. It's because there were more states because the Soviet Union broke up. So I think that And where it varies, where as 3% rises or falls, it tends to be when the business cycle is strong, there's more migration. When it's weak, there isn't. So it's to some extent demand driven. But I think if we're really serious about tackling migration as an issue, we need to look at it more diagnostically. And I just add one more thing on that, if you don't mind.
Just go ahead.
I think in general, pulling back from this, I think one of the problems with society today is that in how we think about social problems, we're still medieval. What do I mean? Well, in the medieval times...
It's an interesting point.
Well, let me explain. I mean it in a very precise way or a very specific way. If you look at the study of medicine, I mentioned the Black Death before, how in the 14th century, people will have looked at the pustules and thought that's the disease when it's actually the symptom of the disease. Until we developed a sort of modern biomedical model where we understood the difference between symptom and disease, we were not in a position to cure what ails the physical body, what problems the physical body faces. I think we are still medieval in how we think about what ails the body politic, because we still have a tendency to look at disease, to look at symptoms and confuse them. And so if you look at, to give you an example, in America the last few years, it tends to be that the people who vote for Trump will look at the kind of woke people in New York City and say, they're the disease destroying America, we're the cure. And then, of course, the people in New York or the woke people look at the people voting for Trump and say, they're the disease and we're the cure. But what I see when I look at them is two symmetrical symptoms of a shared disease in need of a cure. Because if you look at the older Americans in voting for Trump, you know, to stereotype them, they tend to be older, more blue collar, in parts of the country in the middle where their jobs have all gone to China or something, right? The car factories and so on. And the establishment's not representing them. So who do they turn to? A non-establishment figure like Trump. So in a sense, they are suffering a problem of sort of neoliberal capitalism not valuing them and taking their meaning away in their lives and so on. And this leads to them voting for Trump. But then if you look at the kind of younger, to stereotype, you know, degree educated people living in New York City, typically they've got massive student debt. They've got they've got 0 hours contracts. They can't find a solid job. They have they can't buy a house. The house is too expensive. And so in a sense, they are also suffering the deprivations of this neoliberal economy. And so in a sense, the older people in middle America and the younger people in the coast, they hate each other, but actually they seem to share the same problem. And it seems to me that it serves the, if you look at the corporations doing that, well, they're, I guess, if you look at social media through which all of this stuff is filtered, these debates between the left and the right and the Trumps and the wokes people, they hate each other through social media. That's how they encounter each other typically. Well, guess what? Social media, they're all on it for free because they don't pay for it. Who pays for it? Well, corporations who advertise. So actually the customer of the social media companies is not you and I who use it. It's the corporations who do the advertising. We're just the product. And everyone knows if you divide and rule, then people are not noticing the corporate factors that have impacted everyone's lives. Among other reasons why there's divide and rule on social media. But it's but my point is that throughout this, what I see across the political spectrum is that there's a constant misdiagnosis of problems. Is that one side looks at the other and say, you're the disease, I'm the cure, and vice versa. And again, I look at it and I see symmetrical symptoms of a shared disease in need of a cure. And if we are serious about not polarizing our societies to the point that they fall into sort of civil war and entropy, if we're serious about that, and we're also serious adults about wanting to solve problems, we have to start diagnosing things in a way that are not part of the problem. And and on these issues, I'm strictly quite nonpartisan on it because, you know, I'm an academic, I'm a researcher, I think it'd be immoral for me to begin from a political position before an analytical one. Yes. And I don't have answers, but I do think we're often poorly framing the questions. And the same problem manifests when we look at issues around migration.
So we can spot the same patterns. Even within demography, within climate change.
Yeah, because if you look at the migration debate, both sides have some points on these issues. The left have a point about, it is true that typically when migrants come to, say, the UK, on average, the data shows they tend to be younger, healthier, and harder working than the native population. We're not getting the people from Africa who are poorest. Meloni right now in Italy is trying to stop migration from Africa. So her policy is to invest in development in Africa. But this goes against all migration research, which demonstrates that if the country develops, you'll get more emigration because people have the resources to travel. So she's not actually curing the problem. She's misdiagnosing the problem and going to probably create a bigger problem for herself. Now, this is why these questions matter. So the left have a point about the relationship between wealth and migration. We're not getting the poorest migrants. But the right have a point that if you have accelerated diversification and family chain migration and so on, you end up with ethnic enclaves, you end up with demographic shifts and so on. Both have a point. And at the moment, both think the other side is immoral and so on. And I have to say, having seen these debates for long enough, it gets a bit tedious of how polarized it is. Because I think there are solutions, the smartest solutions are ones that thread the needle. Not compromise in a way where you don't please anyone, but where you reframe what the problem is. And again, I think as long as everyone's diagnosing the symptoms, everyone gets good politics out of it, but I'm not convinced we'll actually fix the problems.
And actually, to sum up our discussion, we should really be aware that there might be a linkage between climate and migration, but we should be very aware that there might be that there isn't actually, and I strongly recommend this book, namely The Climate Migration: Critical Perspectives for Law, Policy, and Research, edited by Callum Nicholson and Benoit Meyer, to read because it's a fascinating book. I mean, I really liked it. And unfortunately, this is the end of our podcast, of our MCC Diplomacy podcast. Callum, thank you very much once again for being with us today. And for our dear listeners, I wish you a happy new year. Goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this MCC podcast episode. For further media content, please look up our English website at mcc.hu/en or look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you want to read more by our professors, external contributors, and students, check out our knowledge base at corvinek.hu/en.